I guess I don't see Dr. April here. I'll introduce myself. I'm Brian. I'm one of the chief residents in orthopedics. And Dr. April asked me to come give this talk. I've given this talk a few times now, and the students seem to like it, so we'll do it again this year. I was sitting in the same seats about 10 years ago as a first-year student. It seems weird that it's been this long. I remember Pete Davey. That guy can probably take your exams by now. Probably do okay. But the whole idea of clinical correlations is that you guys get an idea of why what you're studying actually matters and how it applies clinically to what we do surgically as well as in medicine. And this course is probably the most comprehensive anatomy course throughout the entire country. And I think if you talk to your other friends, you guys will find that. Nobody else has a full year of anatomy. It's insane.
It's insane.
The good part about that is that you will know more than any other student in the country about anatomy. The hard part about it is you're shoved so many things that you actually don't even know what's really important and what's applicable. So that's one of the reasons we're giving this talk. The second reason is maybe to get you a little bit excited about orthopedics. It's not too early to think about what you want to do when you grow up. And the last part is we're going to talk about the spine. And your family members, I'm sure, they hear you're in medical school, your grandfather, your grandmother, they think you're a doctor. They don't know the difference between an attending, a medical student, intern, or resident. And they're going to say, I'm going to get my spine fused. What do you think of that? And you're going to look at them like you have no idea what you're talking about. So at the end of this, hopefully you'll know, it's a long talk. I'll warn you, it's about 100 slides, so I'm going to go really, really quickly. I ask that you don't take any notes, and if you guys want to copy this talk, I can give it to Dr. April, and you guys can review it later. But if you take notes, you're not going to be able to get everything that's on here. If you have a question, just raise your hand and ask the question. So we're going to go through some very basic anatomy, then some case studies of typical pathology. So 90% of what you're going to see when somebody comes in with pain in the neck or pain in the back. We're going to go through the surgical treatments as well as some relevant anatomy, and then also some new technologies. And how I'm going to frame it is I'm going to put the anatomy in the framework of the pathology, and I find that that's useful. So before we go to this next slide, I also want to say that not all orthopedists actually come from the freeway club. And I want to make a plug for my own subspecialty that there are a lot of different aspects of orthopedics, from total hip to spine, cervical spine, hand. It's interesting stuff. With that being said, this is a clip from my favorite movie.
Are you ready? Are you ready for some football? You want the noise brought on you? Because here it comes.
What? The noise brought on you? Because here it comes.
Just hike the ball, my job.
Ready, set,
oh,
hike,
no.
Hike.
It's not showing. It's good, though. It's a Wedding Crashers video. I don't know why it's not showing. Oh, no. It's like the best part of the whole talk right here. It's even funny without the video. Pete, can we get this video to work? Where'd he go? He's gone. Oh, that sucks. Let's see, I'm going to try this one more time.
You ready for some football? You want the noise brought on you?
No, I don't think it's going to work.
The noise brought on you, because here it comes.
Oh, it's too bad.
Ready?
It's really good, too. Oh, well. We'll move on. Maybe Pete can fix it later. There are like 3 or 4 of these clips in here. That'll cut you the talk down by 10 minutes. All right, so do you want to try to get it to work? Yeah. Monitor only? Oh, man. That one? I don't know. Oh, yeah. Love it. Yeah. Now everyone's happy.
Because here it comes. What? The noise brought on you. Because here it comes.
Just hike the ball, my job.
Ready, set, hike.
All right, so you guys are going to see a lot of patients, even if you become primary care guys, with back pain. And what you should tell them is that 90% of the patients with back and neck pain will be 90% better in 90 days if you do nothing. So if you're a primary care guy, and actually a lot of people will first get an MRI or whatnot, do nothing. If they don't have sensory motor symptoms, do nothing. The initial treatment is going to be nonsteroidals, relaxants such as Valium, physical therapy. And really, from an orthopedic surgery standpoint, spine surgery is always the last resort. And you're going to hear a lot, there's a lot of bad press out there about spine surgeons, but I will say that in the correct indication, it is the right thing to do. But certainly there are people that are operating on questionable indications. So the first thing we need to do is look at the anatomy. Have you guys all been through this stuff? All right, we'll go over it one more time really quickly. So C1, C2, I'm not going to talk about as much. C1 is the atlas that sits on C2, which is the axis. They're kind of unique, but C3 through C7 are pretty much the same. You have to remember what goes right here. What's in here? Vertebral artery, right? It feeds your brain, I think. And then the spinal cord's here, right? And you can see the pedicle is actually very short, right? And these are the facets, okay? And this is what you have to know. This is a side view of one stacked on top of each other. What comes out through here? Nerve, right? It's pretty straightforward. The things you have to know are that this is the joint of Luschka, which is actually a joint made of the uncinate process, which is the this is actually a facet, but this is almost the anterior facet. You have to know this because as you get degenerative disease, just like osteoarthritis in the knee, you'll get bone production and then this nerve gets impinged. The only thing I'll say about C1, C2 that's important is that 50% of your neck rotation comes from this one articulation of C1, C2. We go to the thoracic spine, which is a little bit larger, and this, the pedicle is a little bit bigger, right? And the facet orientation is horizontal, like a deck of cards. If you splay out a deck of cards, that's the facet orientation. And here, just to orient you, this is the transverse process. This is a rib coming off, right? So this is the inferior facet of this vertebra, and this is the superior facet of this vertebra. And of course, the ribs come off of it, and this may be something that you're asked about. It's pretty logical that the seventh vertebra has a seventh rib, but also articulates with the sixth one up top. The lumbar vertebra, there's a lot of disease that's focused in the lumbar spine, and what you need to know that is that there are ligaments that you have to be careful of and be cognizant of that are normal and that are there normally, but can hypertrophy. So there's ligamentum flavum, which is actually back here. It's on the inside. It's called a yellow ligament. If you guys dissect this, you take the bone down, you'll see it's a very, very thick ligament. The cord, of course, ends at around L1, L2, right? So if you're on L4, L5, and you take a knife, and you stick a knife through someone's spine at L4, L5, does it go through the spinal cord? Not so much, right? It only ends at L1, L2. One relationship I want you to keep in mind is that if you draw a line, meaning if you're getting an MRI and you're looking at the axial cut, in one single cut, you can get the disc, you can get the facet, and you can get the nerve. So a lot of spine surgeons, when they're looking for nerve compression, they're going to look for that place where you see a facet joint on the axial, and you're going to know the disc is there and the nerve is there as well. And you can see that here. And this is another relationship that's good to know. In the lumbar spine, not in the cervical spine, the L4 nerve root comes out from under the L4 body. All right? L4 nerve root comes out from underneath the L4 body. And this is going to be important with your, you know, when you look at your slip disc and look at where the pathology is. So this is why ELLIS is great, not only because you can tell your family about what it's like being a spine surgeon, but when you're eating dinner or you're at Outback Steakhouse, you can actually tell them what's in a T-bone steak. So T-bone steak is this. Transverse process is the T. Paraspinal muscle's back here. Psoas muscle in here. See that? Same thing. So if you take these two halves, that's an entire vertebral body. All right, so imaging orientation. When you look at a CT scan, you're going to put up CTs, and you're going to see these in surgeries if you guys ever scrub in. What's right, what's left? Always remember that you're standing at the patient's feet. If you're standing at the patient's feet and looking up at the patient, this is an axial cut. This is the right side, this is the left side, okay? To make it a little bit more confusing, if you're looking at scoliosis films, and you want to know what's right or left, we put the film up as if you were standing behind the patient. Because you're going to, you know, like the Allen forward bending test, if you ever get a physical at school and they're telling you to bend forward and they're looking at your spine, which is actually only a useless test, but in any case, you're standing behind the patient, so right side is right, left side is left. This becomes important later on. All right, so radiographic anatomy, I know you guys don't go through this as much. We'll go through it briefly. This is an AP, so the projection is front to back. These are the pedicles. You see these little owl eyes here? Those are the pedicles, right? These are the spinous processes. The lateral is pretty straightforward also. There's discs right here, vertebral bodies. The nerves come out through here, right? The foramen. And then here's the oblique, which to you guys looks like it's not that helpful, but actually it is helpful in defining some pathology that we're going to go through later on. We'll come back to this slide. So what surgical approaches can you use? Surgery is not really rocket science. You can either go from the front, go from the back, or go from the side. So how do you decide which way to go? It's based on where the pathology is. Except, of course, if you're above L1, L2, because the cord's there, right? In which case, it may not be so good to always go from the back. So we'll talk about degenerative disc disease, which if you have grandparents or you have older parents that are asking you about back pain, 90% of it is going to be degenerative disc disease. So the first thing is the natural course of a disc. This is a disc. If you guys have a chance to look at it, it's like a jelly donut. It's got a fibrous outside and it's got a jelly inside, nucleus pulposus, annulus fibrosus around. And you can get stenosis, meaning there's a stricture, a narrowing. The stenosis can be two ways, two flavors, is central, meaning in the canal, or foraminal, meaning outside. All right, so we'll go through a couple of cases, and these may be some cases that you'll see on your exam. I'm told that you guys are presented kind of case-based stuff. So we'll go through it briefly. 65-year-old, hypertension, low back pain, no history of trauma, a cramping and heaviness in the legs, and the pain is better when she's shopping at the grocery store or leaning forward. The exam is basically benign. Straight leg raise is a test for a slipped disc. She's 4 to 5 strength, 5 is full strength, and it's kind of nonspecific findings. And her symptoms are mostly back pain, also some leg pain. And she has degenerative disease. And the reason she has degenerative disease is both central and foraminal. There's disc bulging here at L4-5. You can see the facet here, right? So you get facet hypertrophy. This is the flavum. See that thickened flavum? And this is where the spinal nerve comes out. So you have impingement centrally from the flavum, peripherally from a little bit of the disc, also a little bit of hypertrophy of this facet. Hypertrophy just means growing big. So there are lots of areas as your body gets older and ages that this degenerates. You get these osteophytes that can impinge on the nerve. So this is a great pathological sagittal section. So the discs are here. They don't look healthy, right? They don't look healthy, and there are all these little spurs. And this is without the soft tissue. Spine shouldn't look like that, right? And that's an x-ray of it without everything. So you can see all these spurs that are impinging. So this is degenerative disease. So if we're going to image this lady, what are we going to do? Well, we can get an x-ray, which you guys have already seen. Next, we get an MRI. And you can definitely see that there's a little bit of pinching here. This is L5, this is S1. So there's a little bit of narrowing here. And a test that's neat is a myelogram. You inject dye into the canal. So if somebody asks you what's a myelogram, you inject dye inside the canal. Here's another axial cross-section to show that you have kind of narrowing centrally as well as peripherally here. So this is dye in the canal. So you're taking an x-ray and the dye is seen and the roots are not seen. That kind of makes sense? So here you see an entire blockage, right? You see a blockage here of the dye. Like there's good dye filling here, not so much here, and not so much down here. So that's stenosis, that's narrowing. So non-operative, we already talked about, we're surgeons, we like to operate. So what are we gonna do? It's pretty straightforward, right? If this is tight, we should just take all this stuff out. Well, how are we gonna do that posterior? In a lumbar spine, we position them prone. Now, you guys know the names of all these muscles. I don't. Forgot them all. Not that important. Important for the test. Not that important surgically. You make a midline incision, and all you do is you come subperiosteally, and you go all the way down the midline, okay, just like that. See that? You can go out to the facets. And once you see the facets, you do a decompression. So you're decompressing stenosis. How do you do a decompression? The decompression is done by taking all this stuff out. If you take all this stuff out, you can imagine there's a significant loss of stability of the spine, right? So a huge thing in spine surgery is how do you stabilize the spine if you decompress for stenosis? How do you actually make the spine rigid because if you don't, the segments are going to fall on top of each other. So this is a development that has revolutionized spine surgery. It's called a pedicle screw. So a pedicle screw is placed posteriorly anterior. It's an actual screw. It's about 6.5 millimeters in diameter in a lumbar spine. And you actually drill the screw in posteriorly anteriorly. And if you put this screw in and you're screwing it in, you can lift the entire patient off the table. It's got that much hold in the pedicle. How do you actually put the pedicle screw in? Because you can imagine if you're looking from up top, the patient's body is here, right? You can't see the pedicle. How do you know where it is? 100% based on anatomy. So somebody came along and said, if you're looking from the back, these are where all the pedicles are. You got to find where the transverse process is. You got to find where the facet is, and at the intersection is where the pedicle is. Meaning if I take a mallet and a nail and drive this to the floor, the pedicle's there. All based on anatomy. So we're guessing, looking P to A, the pedicle's here, and I can show you from the side view, obviously it's easy, right? The pedicle's right there. So what's the problem with that? If you breach the medial cortex, your spinal nerves you can get, here's the pedicle, this is medial, this is lateral. And if you're up in the thoracic cord, what happens? You can paralyze people. The other problem is if you're too deep, don't forget the aorta sits on the left side in the thoracic spine, you can also get the aorta. So if you know the anatomy, it's easy. If you don't know the anatomy and you don't know what you could potentially hit, it's not so great. So here you see the axial, and this is in the pedicle, right? Here's a screw. Here's a screw that's trying to be in the pedicle. The aorta is here. See that? It's the left T12 screw. So you can easily see how you can get part of the aorta. All right, so now that we decided we're going to decompress it, meaning we'll take all the bone off, that's easy. So here you see there's bony elements here, the spinous processes. Here it's all gone. It's hollow. And then you put some pedicle screws from front to back, connected by two rods. And the idea is if you fuse the segment into one giant ball of bone, it's not going to move. So you decompress it and then fuse it with bone graft. And you see a lateral view. And here's another one. You see that? This is a four-level decompression fusion. So most family members will be getting, if they have stenosis, will be getting some sort of decompression as well as fusion. All right, now we'll go up into the neck and the cervical spine. So this is also degenerative disease in the cervical spine. So 56-year-old female, no past medical history, complains of several years of neck pain, bilateral arm pain. Did you guys do brachial plexus yet? Oh, it's going to be brutal. Oh, no. It's so painful. Bilateral arm pain, difficulty buttoning her shirt, fine motor activities. I will tell you that these are symptoms of central cord compression in the cervical spine. Not peripheral in the spinal nerves, central cord compression in the cervical spine. These people have a wide base gait. They're hyperreflexic because of an upper motor neuron deficit. Did you guys learn about the upper motor neuron, lower motor neuron? So upper motor neuron, you're going to have increased reflexes, right? So she's got increased reflexes in the biceps and triceps, right? So C5 and C7. And when the index finger is flicked, the thumb flexes. And you guys know what the Babinski is for the lower extremity? Not so much. All right. This is a sign where you flick the finger and the thumb flexes in. It's a soft sign for upper motor neuron. Basically means that something's happening in the canal, in the cord itself, and not peripherally. So this is the cervical spine. So you can also get disc degeneration, and now you get central compression from the posterior longitudinal ligament, which is here. This is anterior. This is posterior. Ligament sits here, and you can also get those osteophytes we talked about, right? And here is showing this is the atlas sitting on the axis. This is C3, 4, 5, 6, and these are osteophytes. You can see degeneration, and this is a lateral view showing degeneration. And also the uncovertebral joint we talked about, these joints of Luschka, which are here, the nerves come out here, so if it's hypertrophied here, you might be able to compress the nerve over here. And there are more views of just something that's degenerative. So again, we like to operate. How do we decompress this? Well, before, we could just take off the lamina, you know, if this were the lumbar spine, and in fact, in the cervical spine, you can also do that. Some of the issue is fixation after you take the lamina off, because you're destabilizing the spine. But a lot of the other issue is you need to take stuff off anteriorly because a lot of the offending things are anterior, meaning the posterior longitudinal ligament. So this is a little bit more dicey, right? Because you're going from the front through the neck where the throat is to get to the spine. So you go on the left side. The recurrent laryngeal nerve is a little bit more risky on the right side, which is why you go on the left side. So laterally, you go through the sternocleidomastoid and the carotid sheath, and you have the strap muscles medially. Right. think you can see that here. It's a little bit better view. So you're trying to get here, right? You're trying to decompress this disc or this body. So you cut the fascia in between the sheath as well as the strap muscles, and you can get down right on top of the body from the front. So now you're cutting the neck from the front and getting the pathology from the front. Now there are a lot of bad things around here, but the things you want to be careful of, this, the sympathetic trunk, you can get a Horner syndrome, I'm sure you learned about that. You can get the vertebral artery, which is here. That's not great. And of course, you can get the recurrent laryngeal, you get some hoarseness. So once you're in there anteriorly, you can distract, you can take and you can burr out from the front this bone, and then you can tamp in some bone graft, and you secure it with some plates from front to back. So here's a pre-op MRI. You can see that there's a disc coming out here from front to back. Can't see that so well. And this, do you have the volume down? Pete. Pete fell asleep. I'm happy you guys fell asleep. All right, let me preface this by saying that this is the head. This is the left side of the person's body. This is the foot. And this is Dan Rue, who's a very well-known cervical spine surgeon in WashU. So this is an anterior cervical discectomy and fusion, which is another one the most common spine surgeries have. It's called an ACDF, anterior cervical discectomy and fusion. So you're going to go through, and that's a protected Bovie tip, and get all the bleeders. So you're going to go through the platysma. That's that shaver's muscle, do you guys know about. So you're going to bring the carotid sheath and the sternocleidomastoid mastoid laterally, and then medially you're going to have the strap muscles. So that's a retractor going in. And interestingly enough, with this small incision, he can go from C3 to C7. You can make a mobile window and move the entire window up, all the way up in the cervical spine and down. So this is coming down, and you can already see that the vertebral body and these little indentations here are the disc. So they're peaks and valleys, right? So he's coming down, and what's right past this disc in the vertebral body? So he's taking a Bovie and coming down over the body and kind of clearing it off medially and laterally. So what's right over is the spinal cord, right? So if you go through this body and you go a little bit too deep, now you're on the cord. So it takes an extreme amount of practice and also knowledge of the anatomy to know how far deep to go and what you're looking for. So the first structure you're going to see is, of course, the posterior longitudinal ligament. So he's taking a knife and cutting out the disc. So that's disc coming out. This is one vertebral body. That's another vertebral body. It's not as clear as I hoped. And then you can take, you know, little instruments, metal instruments, to scrape out the disc in the front. And now you take two pins, one in the front, one in the back, and you crank open the disc space. So that's a pin on the vertebral body down low. That's one on top. And you can put a distracting device on and then crank it open. This is definitely the scariest part right here that's come up. It's a 5 millimeter diamond tip burr that he takes along the, that's the more disc material coming out. So he takes a diamond tip burr and he goes all the way down, bouncing off the posterior longitudinal ligament in the cord, which is, most appendings here do not do that, right here. You take a burr and you just burr down the entire thing. And he claims that if you go fast enough, you don't get the cord. That being said, he's like probably the most famous cervical spine surgeon in the world, definitely in the country, but he does 10 of these cases in a day. He'll run two rooms, five in each room. He does this procedure in 45 minutes. All right, so you take out the disc, and you're taking out the offending structures, right, all those osteophytes. Now remember, if you go too far right or left, you're going to get the vertebral artery, right? Vertebral artery sits here and here. So then after you do that, you have a space, you put in your bone graft or whatever, and you put a plate anterior. I didn't show you putting the plate on. But you just put a plate on. All right, so that's the general disease. I'm going to go to herniated disc. This is more relevant to kind of the younger guys or younger ladies out there in the audience, where you get this acute back pain, you get pain coming down the back of the leg. A lot of people will say, I have sciatica. What does sciatica mean? It's just pain coming down the back of the leg. So you get degenerative disc, which is part of aging, but you can also get it as a result of trauma. It is radiating leg pain. And the leg pain is always worse than the back pain. You see patients coming in, they're like, my leg is killing me. It's actually coming from their back and the spinal nerve being compressed. And if you know the dermatomal distribution, you can actually guess where the disc is. Some surgeons, not in this country, but some surgeons actually, based on the physical exam, operate and know where the disc is. So this is what you have to know, and I'm sure this is in your textbook, but the most common disc is at 4 and 5. And remember, L4 comes out between L4 and L5, right, the L5 pedicle. So you would think that a disc herniation here at L4-5 is going to get the nerve root that comes out there. It actually doesn't, since most herniations have a soft spot right here in the annulus, and it actually is a central or posterior lateral herniation, which is here. And it can't get the 4 root because the 4 root already came off. Get that? So an L4-5 disc will 90% of the time get an L5 nerve root, which is actually coming out beneath L5. So if you know the sensory motor and reflexes, you're going to be able to diagnose exactly where the disc is. So typically at L4-5, you're going to get an L5 disc. They're going to say, I have some decreased sensation in my first lead space, extensor hallucis longus. All you do is you tell them to take their big toe, point it up, and you push down at the end of the big toe. If they can extend their EHL, it's probably not a 4-5 disc. There's no reflex at 5. And L4 actually has some contribution to L3 telereflex. But a very simple exam for somebody with disc is have them walk on their toes and then have them walk on their heels. Toe walking is gastroc soleus, which is here, S1. Heel walking, they have to keep their foot up. That's tibialis anterior. If they can do that and this, it's not L4, it's not S1. And if they can do EHL, it's not L5. Okay? So a ton of people, I was in med school, two guys actually have herniated discs. So here's L5, that's S1. You see this big Goomba right here? Sitting there. Now what's here? Is it spinal cord right here? No, it's not the cord, right? It's just the nerve roots. No big deal. So this here, you see this big thing right here sitting there. L5, S1. 90% get better by 90 days. Now, this is if they don't have significant progressive neurologic deficit. So if you have weakness in any of those areas, you have to start thinking about operating. Also, cauda equina, which we're going to go through. How do you do a discectomy? Same thing. Posterior approach. The pathology is posterior. You can go posterior because you're in a lumbar spine. You just make a little window with a burr. Sneak in between. Remember we said the facet, the disc, the nerve are at the same level. You just come through, retract, take this, and then you pop in with a little grasper and you grab the jelly out of the jelly donut, and that's it, and you close up. There's no fusion, right? There's no instability. You're just making a little cortical window. So here, you see that little window? It looks like somebody bit out of it, like an apple. Right there. Right there. Get the 5-1 disc. One thing you have to be careful of, and this, if you take anything away from this lecture, there are a few things in spine surgery that threaten your life and limb. This is one of them, cauda equina syndrome. It's when you get the lower nerve roots that are central, S2, S3, S4, as you guys know, and also a little bit L5, and then what you can get is this constitution of symptoms. You get saddle anesthesia, which is on the buttock area. You get weakness, but more importantly, you have bowel and bladder paralysis, meaning you get incontinence, you get overflow incontinence because you can't control your bladder, so your bladder fills up and it starts overflowing. So you get overflow incontinence, and that is an absolute surgical emergency. You see somebody that's in the emergency room, they better be in your operating room in the next 8 hours. And you can see here that the central nerve roots, sacral nerve roots are central. So it really has to do with the bowel and bladder paralysis. So a part of any history and physical with somebody with back pain, you have to ask, are you having any bowel or bladder problems?
I think he's on steroids. I'm not trying to cover a fucking race horse.
We'll put him in the post.
No, I got a better idea. Look, I'm going to make my post, throw an interception to clear, get her to feel good, you know. Get some involved. You think you can do that?
Yeah, it's first team all state. I can put the ball wherever I want to. I'll make it rain out here.
All right, guys, bring it in. Blue 17! Blue 17! Right there.
Oh, you're going to cover me.
Like white on rice.
All right, I like my odds here. I'm going to give you a little warning. We're going downtown.
Red 7!
Look for me in the end zone after this play. I'll be the guy holding the ball.
John!
What?
Red 7!
I don't know what red 7 means.
Hot route!
I don't. What is hot route?
Will you just go stand on the other side, please?
Are you gonna wait for me?
No, I'm just getting over here.
Down! Ready, down, set!
So fatigue fractures and repetitive fractures and pain in younger people, the number one cause of low back pain in adolescents, so 13-year-old kids, is because of something called spondylolysis. So just remember, there are a lot of these spondylos. Just think lysis is something that's lytic, something that's eaten away. So it's a lytic lesion in the pars interarticularis. What does that mean? Pars interarticularis. So inter is between, articularis are the articular segments. So here's one articular segment. Here's another articular segment. This is the pars interarticularis. So you get a defect in this area. And a lot of people think it's from repetitive trauma and hyperextension, so gymnasts and things like that. People that do things where they're bending way, way back. They're mostly L5 because the L5 pars is actually very thin. This is where that oblique view is helpful. And there are orthopedic residents that still can't understand it, so I'm hoping you guys can kind of begin to get a grasp of this. This is an oblique view, not an AP, not a lateral, an oblique. So you're looking at a spine model obliquely. This is the back spinous process. That's the front. And you've heard of people talk about the Scotty dog. A collar on the Scotty dog means that this is broken. All right? So this is the nose of a Scotty dog. Here's his ear. Here's a foot. Here's another foot. That's a tail. All right? So you see that? 2 feet, a nose, and then the pedicle is his eye. And there's a facet, that's the ear. So you'll hear a lot of people talking. You see on radiology reports, let's say broken neck of a Scotty dog. That's what they're talking about, a pars interarticularis defect. Well, what happens if you break that? If that's broken, what can happen is one vertebra can actually slip on top of another one, and that's actually what we call spondylolisthesis. So this is broken. This is S1. This is L5. You see L5 is now falling on S1 because this is not intact. Now, what nerve root is that going to get? Well, 4 or 5 slips, what's going to happen is you're going to pinch the 4 nerve root, because the 4 nerve root is what's coming out at the foramen. And if you imagine 4 slips on 5, you're going to get a narrower foramen at L4-5. Does that kind of make sense? So again, you have to kind of know where the pathology is. So for a disc, at 4-5, you're getting the L5 root. For a spondylolisthesis, at L4-5, you're getting the L4 root. Well, I spent a little bit of time about cervical injuries in athletes. It's very prevalent in the press right now, and it's something I want to talk briefly about so you just have some knowledge of it. Number one sport is football for cervical spine injuries. They estimate that 10 to 15% will have C-spine injuries if you combine the high school, professional, and college football players, and these are devastating C-spine injuries. And you can see here, in between 75 and 95, 244 young, healthy athletes with permanent cervical paraplegia. And this is something from 2006, and Dr. Baker, who's an orthopedic surgeon at Houston Clinic, saying that injuries are a part of the sport. And you guys know about this guy, of course, Kevin Everett, earlier this year, where he had a fracture dislocation, C3, C4, impending paraplegia. This guy is somebody you have to pay tribute to. Joseph Torg is an orthopedic surgeon. He dedicated his life to studying cervical spine injuries in the athlete. And what he did was create a registry, and he studied video. He studied video of why patients are getting cervical spine injuries, and he came up with a lot of different hypotheses, and one of them I'll talk about here today. But before that, we'll talk about, so in general, what can happen. So of course, you're going to get your cervical sprains. It's just soft tissue. Put them a soft collar, you do NSAIDs, whatever, it's fine. There are neurologic injuries where the nerves are coming out, as well as bony fracture dislocations, which of course are the most lethal, and then we'll talk about this as well. So the first thing is, if anyone here has ever played football, rugby, or anything like that, you know what a burner or a stinger is. You get hit automatically, it's like an electric shock coming down your arm, and then you have a temporary time of paralysis. They can't move their arm. It's a blunt force, and the idea is a burner equals a stinger equals a neopraxia, meaning you stretch the nerve out. It's a sharp burning, and people think it's from a brachial plexus stretch. And this, trust me, I know you guys don't know this now. By exam time, after you reviewed this, you're going to know every branch of this thing. So it's not as helpful to go through now, but I do want to say that this is, you know, C4, C5, 6, 7, C8T1, brachial plexus is C5 to T1. You get traction injury, and you can see why people, when they come off the field, they're holding their arm like this. They're internally rotated. They're extended because they have no elbow flexion, their shoulders adducted because their deltoids out, so they're like this. It looks like they have a dead arm. So this, again, knowledge of anatomy to know where the lesion is, to know what muscles are affected. All right, last clip.
11, 42, 13. Come on, Hunter!
almost all spinal cord injuries, meaning if you have a cord injury, you have a neuropraxia, you have paralysis or such with fracture, this just shows fracture dislocation combined in 30-something percent of patients with cervical spine injury. Now, TORG, this is his kind of claim to fame, why this happens. Biomechanically, I like orthopedics also because you think about things biomechanically, there's a normal lordosis, meaning the neck is kind of bent back normally. If you tilt your head forward, you turn that lordosis into a straight axial line. You study this biomechanically. If you have an axial line, you have progressive axial force. What happens? It makes sense that your cervical spine buckles and fractures. So it's with that head down position, and TORG deemed that spear tackling. So you got here spear tackling, and he had C4 to C6 fracture with paraplegia. In 1976, the NCAA, as well as High School Football Association, said no player shall intentionally strike an opponent with the crown or the top of the helmet, i.e. spear tackling, and they're supposed to really teach, you know, high school players as well as college players how to tackle to avoid this biomechanically disadvantage. So you can see from 1970 to here, this is a number of patients with quadriplegia in football. And TORG had a huge hand in reducing the number of fractures. And this is Everett, and he is over here. The sound is a little bit low, but you look at his head position when he's
tackling. The game would be delayed 15 minutes as Everett was immobilized before being lifted into the ambulance. John Murphy is a Buffalo Bills broadcaster.
I talked to medical sources, and they tell us that Kevin Everett suffered a fractured, dislocated neck with some injuries to his spinal cord. They tell us he has some feeling and movement in his extremities, and doctors...
Unfortunately, I think this is how a lot of people tackle, particularly in the NFL as well as in college, and it's somewhat of a public awareness type of thing, and every time something like this happens, the public becomes more aware. You guys should be aware that it is common. It happens in football players. It's with this kind of spear tackling, and that if it's fractured and dislocated, we need to fix it, and obviously, again, to stabilize it. So how do you stabilize it? Posteriorly, the pedicles are very small in the cervical spine. So you guys already know what to do anteriorly, right? We come down just like that, cervical decompression effusion, and you put a plate here with bone graft. Sometimes you have to go posteriorly, and there's this chunk of bone called the lateral mass that's right here posteriorly, and that's this chunk of bone right here in all three views, where you can sink a tiny 11-millimeter screw in. And you just be aware when you're doing posterior anteriorly of the vertebral artery again. So you have to know the angle at which your hand is going in. This sinks a little bit too deep, you get the vertebral artery. We did this, unfortunately, in the patient a few weeks ago, which can be devastating. So here you see somebody that has an anterior cage as well as posterior fixation. And the idea is to fuse the spine. So Everett got something similar to this. Last thing I'm going to talk about is scoliosis, also because it's prevalent in the adolescent population. Scoliosis is, you think about it as a curved spine. There are lots of etiologies. There's adult, there's pediatric. Really, the guidelines for surgery are based on the, simply kind of the angle of the curve. This should obviously be straight. And these days we're operating if it's greater than 50 degrees in this plane. This is the front back. So the goal is to halt progression. And prevent the halt progression and or correct some of the curve. In kids, you can actually correct the curve. They're very flexible. How do you fix it in the vertebra? There are screws, hooks, and wires. The screws are really what is the mainstay these days, and I showed you earlier how to put in the pedicle screw. This is the thoracic spine. Again, somebody came along and knew that exactly at that point, you know this anatomy, this is the facet, this is the transverse process, that's exactly where the pedicle is. A little bit too medial, you get the cord in this case. A little bit too lateral, you're going to miss the pedicle and you're going to miss your fixation. So again, completely based on anatomy. The first thing we do is get an AP. Again, this is right, this is left. And you want to see how flexible this is, right? So simply, you tell the patient, 13-year-old girl or whatnot, bend to the right and you can see how the curve bends out. Bend to the left and you can see how this curve bends out. So then you have to get bending if it was for scoliosis. And this is somebody with scoliosis. This was not one of our patients. This is one of our patients that we operated on last year. And what happens if you don't operate? They say, I'm scared of surgery. The mother's scared of surgery. I don't want my kid to get the operation. What will happen is, if you're 50 degrees, natural course history studies show us that you will progress 1 degree per year after adolescence, right? So that means by the time you're 50, if you're 50 degrees now and you're 13, that's another 35, 37 degrees. plus 50, you're going to have an 87-degree curve in your spine. Who really cares if you have an 87-degree curve? It definitely affects your respiratory function by the time you're around 90 degrees. And also, it's cosmetically not appealing, and the worst part about it is it's painful. That is why we operate later stage for adult scoliosis, mostly for curve pain. So what are we going to do? Well, we want to fix all the thoracic, all the lumbar areas with pedicle screws, right? So we come down, this is her spine. So we come down, this is the back, this is the lumbar area, this is thoracic. You guys saw this picture already, right? And now if the surgeon hands you a screw or a burr and says, burr along here and find me the pedicle here. Well, you're going to know because you know where the transverse process is, you know where the facet is, and you're going to know where the pedicle is. The pedicle is only about 4 or 5 millimeters. There's a very small margin of error. And what you can do in kids is you can put in the rods and you can derotate the spine. Here's a pre-op. Here's a post-op. You see all these pedicle screws? Here's another one, smaller curve. These are screws coming from the side and straighten people out. Big problems. These are big surgeries with scoliosis. Scoliosis surgeries can be up to 8 hours, 10 hours, sometimes 15-hour surgeries. Lots of blood loss, requires a good hospital. We do a ton of scoliosis surgery at this hospital in particular because the ICUs are very good. But they're big surgeries. You're doing nerve monitoring throughout the entire case. And they're putting what's called SSEPs, the somatosensory evoked potentials. They're putting pins where those dermatomes are. So L4 medial ankle, L5, S1 lateral foot. So they're monitoring at all times whether or not your screw is too medial. And of course, you can get infection early with other complications, late complications. This is not great, right? The rod actually broke from increased stresses, and then you have revision scoliosis surgery, which is really painful to do. Some new technologies I'll talk briefly about because you're going to see this in the media. Kyphoplasty. Vertebral compression fractures are one of the most common fractures of osteoporosis in elderly women. You get wedging, and it's just a little compression fracture. It can be very painful. So somebody come up with the idea where percutaneously you just use fluoroscopy, and you stick a hollow cannula through the back, and using x-ray, guide a cannula into the pedicle and into the body, like that. So the skin's all intact, it's just a little nick. You make a tiny nick here, and you localize it, you blow a balloon up, you put cement in there, it hardens, that's the cement, and that's the cement inside the vertebral body to try to jack the spine back up. It's cool surgery, it's fast surgery, until you get cement that starts to leak into the spinal canal, you get cement that leaks anterior, when it hardens, it burns the aorta, it burns the spinal nerves. There are a lot of things to think about in what's in close proximity to the vertebral body. And the last thing, of course, is total disc replacement. They say for discogenic pain, which means, as I said, degenerative discs, meaning I get an MRI, you have a black disc, you're 35 years old, they say maybe it's coming from that black disc, let's replace the disc. What's the advantage of doing this versus before we put screws in and fuse it? You retain motion. You retain motion between two lumbar segments. There are lots of trials going on total discs, and it is questionable as to the results and the complications, as you can imagine, can be fatal. This is an anterior surgery. You go through the belly, just like in the neck, except in the belly, and you go through the front, scrape out the disc, and you tamp in this artificial disc. And it's supposed to retain motion. The orthopedic surgeon down at NYU who patented this, I think he got $200 million for the patent. There are a lot of devices in spine surgery, and I would just warn you to be very careful about what's out there and kind of read the evidence-based medicine. This is the disc, and this is the disc actually implanted from the front into somebody's spine. So very limited upside, very big downside, and beware of new technologies, particularly when you guys are kind of out there practicing on your own. This is true for any field. So the last slide. You know, I put this up last year, and everyone laughed, and, you know, I asked some people in the audience what's wrong with this picture. And obviously the book is upside down, right? But if you really look closer, you think the book is upside down? See this little cat here? Where should that cat be if the book is upside down? Cat should be here, right? The doctored picture. All right. So if you guys have any questions about orthopedics, you want to observe some surgeries, you want to scrub, write down my contact information, email me. I'm around for another, I'm going to fellowship in 7 months. So feel free to contact me, email me, or whatnot. Thanks.